Well, good morning. We are in the book of 2 Corinthians, so if you want to be turning there, I hope that you'll find an outline laying around to follow along as well. We're going to be looking at 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Before we read our text, I'd like to go over a couple of things that are pertinent to the text and to the message this morning. And you see there on your introduction on the outline, these are a couple of things. The first one is a little bit of background into what's going on in Paul's life in the years that we are studying in 2 Corinthians. As Paul is going through Greece and Asia and Galatia and some of those areas over there where Greece is today in Turkey, he's preaching the gospel, he's establishing churches and making disciples. And it's not long before, just as there is today, there are all kinds of people who try to undermine the Christian church, and it was that way from the very beginning of Paul's ministry. And when Paul went to a town, he would initially, it seems, usually go to the Jewish synagogue first. And the reason for that is, or at least one reason, is that the Jewish people should have had a leg up on the rest of the Gentile world as far as understanding the fact that the Messiah had come, that Jesus was the Messiah. They had the Old Testament scriptures. They understood the Old Testament scriptures to some extent, and they were looking for this Messiah. So when Paul goes to the synagogues proclaiming that Jesus was that Messiah, they at least understood the concept of the Messiah. Paul also was preaching that the law, the Old Testament ceremonial law, was fulfilled in Christ, and that it was not pertinent and necessary for them to continue to follow it. And there's where he begins to butt heads with some of the religious leaders. And we call some of these people today, and I'm not sure if Paul called them this, but Judaizers. And Judaizer was someone who was a Judean, a Jewish person, an Israelite. And what he meant by that was these were people who professed to believe in Jesus, but had an additional clause there. And the clause was this, that yes, we're saved by grace, but you have to continue to keep the law. And these people followed, it seems like they followed Paul wherever he went, trying to undermine his message. Paul writes an entire book. The book of Galatians is written dealing with this issue. And we see hints of it here and there in 2 Corinthians that they had affected the 2 Corinthians as well. And this idea that you have to do something in order to earn God's favor is popular with our human nature. Our human nature likes that, because we would rather have just a list or two of things that we have to do in order to go to heaven, in order to please God, just a list of things that we can check off, and we're drawn to that kind of religion. That's why that you see practically every religion in the world is works-oriented, except for Christianity. It's because that appeals to our flesh. You can see that even within the Christian church. I have known people, personally, they were friends of mine, especially when I was in college, that really had no interest in following Jesus Christ. But there was still this element of guilt, this element of fear this element of conscience that bothered them when they did nothing concerning the church or Christianity. And usually these type of people will have some activity that they will do that's faith-related, and it makes them feel good. There are plenty of people in Christian circles, or at least on the fringe of Christian circles, that make their way to church twice a year. When is that? Christmas and Easter. And they feel good about themselves. They live with their conscience the rest of the time, but they can go to church at Easter and suddenly their spirits are lifted and they feel good about their religion because they have checked this box off, went to church. So that appeals to our nature to do something to please God. And the Judaizers were following Paul around saying, yes, we got to believe in Jesus, but you've got to do this. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. You've got to keep the law. So that's one issue that we'll see in our text. And these Judaizers were coming to Corinth and to other churches that they came to, and they had what was called letters of recommendation. And that was letters from the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem saying, here is brother so-and-so, he's a good guy, he's a godly man, listen to him. And so expecting the churches to acknowledge the commendation, recommendation by the church leaders. So that's one issue. There's another thing that I want us to talk about before we look at our text. In fact, we're going to begin by reading in the book of Exodus, chapter 34. But this is an account that we're going to find in our text in 2 Corinthians. In Exodus 34, Moses has gone up on Mount Sinai to meet with God. And Moses has been here before. And at least one of the times that he went on the mountain to meet with God, he came down with the Ten Commandments, with the tablets of stone. When he got to the bottom, his brother Aaron and a lot of the Israelites had made a golden calf to worship it because Moses was taking a little longer than they could put up with in coming back. Moses, in his anger, throws down the tablets that God has engraved for him and breaks them. That's back in the early part of Exodus. Here in Exodus 34, Moses is back on the mountain and God gives them to him again. And I'm going to tell you this, just kind of paraphrase this account the way I have always heard it throughout my life. And you see if this corresponds with your understanding of how the narrative went. Moses comes down from the mountain and he doesn't realize it, but his face is glowing. His face is glowing because he has been in the presence of God. He doesn't realize it. He comes down the mountain and Aaron and all the people that are in his presence notice it. And they are scared because of what they see. And so they back off and they're keeping their distance from Moses. And Moses realizes what is happening and he calls them near and he talks to them and tells them what God has said. But at some point, Moses is compelled to put a veil over his face so that the people can endure being in his presence. So they will not be frightened, perhaps. But for some reason, Moses feels like, and I don't know if it may have been Aaron's idea, but for some reason, Moses puts a veil, covers his face to hide this glow that his face is radiating or reflecting the glory of God from being in God's presence. And Moses, the glow stays there for a while. Now, I don't know how long a while is. I don't know if it's 2 hours. I don't know if it's 2 weeks. But occasionally, Moses goes back to the mount to talk to God. And it seems that when he goes back to the mount and talks to God, he takes the veil off, speaks with God when he is down, and he needs the veil on to calm the people. He puts the veil on. Now, here's a part that I don't know if you have this feeling or not, but I just kind of have always had the feeling, and I think I'm sure I've heard this taught, that at some point this glow begins to fade away. This glow begins to dissipate, to go away. But Moses continues to wear the veil. Now, I have heard it said, and in fact I've read a commentary or two that agreed with this, that Moses realizes that the glow is dissipating, that it is fading away, yet he continues to wear the veil so that the people will not realize that it's fading away. All right, has anybody ever heard that line of thought there, or am I the only one? Two or three? Okay. All right, Warren Wiersbe kind of explains it that way as well. Another option could be that Moses continues to wear the veil because the law, the giving of the law and being in the presence of God is what initiated this spectacular event. And Moses doesn't want to the children of Israel to downplay the glory of the law because this radiance is fading away. Now, in that explanation, Moses has a little better motives, perhaps. All right? Now, I don't know that it's either one. And the two places that you find this incident talked about are in Exodus 34 and in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 that we're going to read today. Now, I want us to go to Exodus 34 and let's read the account. We're going to read all that there is to read about it and see what we can glean from this. Exodus 34, beginning in verse 28. Here's Moses on the mount. We take it up, verse 28. So he was there, Moses was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Now it was so when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testament were in Moses' hand when he came down from the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him or while he talked with God. So when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the children of Israel came near, and he gave them as commandments all that the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out. And he would come out and speak to the children of Israel whatever he had been commanded. Whenever the children of Israel saw the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone, then Moses would put the veil on his face again until he went in to speak with him or with the Lord. All right, now there's what we have in that text. Now let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, and we're going to read the chapter. Second Corinthians chapter 2, begin reading verse 1. Or excuse me, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, chapter 3. I'll get it right in a minute. 2 Corinthians, chapter 3, the entire chapter, verse 1. Do we begin again to commend ourselves? Or do we need, as some others, epistles of recommendation to you, or letters of commendation from you? You are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read by all men. Clearly you are an epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh, that is, of the heart. And we have such trust through Christ toward God, not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think of anything as being from ourselves, but our sufficiency is from God, who also made us sufficient as ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. But if the ministry of death, written and engraved on stones, was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? For if the ministry of condemnation had glory, the ministry of righteousness exceeds much more in glory. For even what was made glorious had no glory in this respect, because of the glory that excels. For if what is passing away was glorious, what remains is much more glorious. Therefore, since we have such hope, we use great boldness of speech, unlike Moses, who put a veil over his face so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the end of what was passing away. But their minds were blinded, for until this day the same veil remains unlifted in the reading of the Old Testament, because the veil is taken away in Christ. But even to this day, when Moses is read, a veil lies on their heart. Nevertheless, when one turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord. If you have your outline, I've entitled the message, Contrasting Epistles. Contrasting Epistles. Paul opens this chapter by asking a couple of questions. Keep in mind that more than likely the Judaizers have found their way to Corinth and have presented their credentials to the church at Corinth. They're saying, we have come with letters of commendation from the church in Jerusalem. Paul, the Apostle Paul, had no such letters. So Paul opens this chapter by asking them a question. He says, do we begin again to commend ourselves? Or do we need, as some others, epistles of commendation to you or letters of commendation from you? Now these are rhetorical questions that drive you toward an expected answer. We may not understand what he's talking about. We may have trouble grasping what's his point and what's going on here, but it's the first thing of understanding that comes to us as we read this is what the answers are to those questions. All right? Do we begin again to commend ourselves? The answer he's expecting is no. Or do we need, as some others, epistles of commendation to you? The answer that is expected is no. Or do we need letters of commendation from you? The expected answer, again, is no. Now, what is Paul's point? Why is this the case? And this is the first point on your outline. Fill in the blanks. Here's the point. While letters of commendation may be useful, they are greatly inferior to the letter written on our hearts and lives by the Spirit of the living God as we minister to one another. That's a long statement. Let me read it again. While letters of commendation may be useful, they are greatly inferior to the letter written on our hearts and lives by the Spirit of the living God as we minister to one another. Paul asks the question, do we need letters of commendation to you? Do we need them from you when we go from here to another place? Then what does he say in verse 2? You are our letter. You are our epistle, written in our hearts, known and read by all men. You are our epistle. Our commendation ought to be your life. What does Paul mean by that? Paul's deep affection for the Corinthian believers ought to have spoken louder than any letter he may have been carrying with him from Jerusalem. They ought to have remembered Paul when he was with them for a year and a half, several years earlier. They ought to have remembered, and Paul is asking them, to pointing them back to this direction. You are our epistles. Think of the time that we spent with you. The fruit that went on in our lives, in your lives, in the church at Corinth. Does that not speak, commend us to you? The work of Christ in their hearts through the ministry of Paul did the same thing as the letters of commendation, only far greater. Now, we use letters of commendation even today. We use them both ways. Let me give you a couple examples. When this church first began to go to Guatemala, we went with a man named Danny Lafferty, or teamed up with them once we got there, I guess would be a better way to say that. Why Danny Lafferty? Don, can you answer that question?
Yeah, one of the ladies in church at the time had been to Guatemala with him from another church, and we just kind of grandfathered in there.
Okay, so there was a lady from our church, who's Christy Allen, who recommended that we go down there and team up with Danny Lafferty because she had done that before. She knew him, and she recommended him to us. And because, and it wasn't that we just, you know, jumped on that like, you know, ugly on an ape. It's just that it was not something that was not thought out, right? Something that we considered. And what did we consider? We considered Christy Allen, right? How reputable is Christy Allen's opinion? Is that something to be considered? Well, sure it is. And that was considered. And so we ended up accepting her recommendation and going down there and ministering with him. About a month or two ago, Steve Osborne comes here. Who recommended Steve Osborne to our church? I would say Don. I think we would all kind of point to Don as involved in that, right? Don introduces Steve to the church. He introduces his ministry in Guatemala. Most of us have never been to Amor del Nino in Guatemala. Don has. Some of you have as well. And the church considers your recommendation or lack thereof for this ministry or for this person. I've been a builder for 30-something years. I cannot think of one house that I built that I was not introduced to the people that I built it by a recommendation that they had gotten from somebody else to contact me. I can't think of any other way I built a house other than that procedure. It is very common. We use it in all spheres of life. Now, that doesn't make it foolproof. All right, I'm going to read you a couple of quotes. This is a quote by a guy that lived 1,002 years ago named Diogenes. he was asked for a letter of commendation by someone, and he answers them this way. He says that you are a man, he will know at a glance. In other words, the guy that you want me to send this recommendation to. He says that you are a man, he will know at a glance. But whether you are a good or a bad man, he will discover if he has the skill to distinguish between good and bad. And if he is without that skill, he will not discover the facts, even though I write to him thousands of times. And what he is saying is that letters of commendation, recommendation may be given, but eventually, what's going to show up is the facts, is your life. And that's true in every situation that I can think of. Someone may tell you that I'm a good guy, but eventually you'll make up your own mind, not by what they said, but by being around me, one way or the other. And it's that way in all spheres of life. And that is the point Paul is making, because that kind of commendation, that kind of convincing is what is weighty, is what carries weight. And that's the point Paul is making. He says, do I need a letter of recommendation to you? Do I? I was there 18 months ministering to you. You are my letter. It was written on your hearts. You are written on my heart. And that will carry enough weight one way or the other. Christians ought to be believing of one another. You ought not to be like me. I start out with having my doubts about everybody. All right, we ought to give people the benefit of the doubt until we're forced to do otherwise. A man named Lucian, who is a pagan satirist, makes this comment that any charlatan can make a fortune out of simple-minded Christians because they are so easily imposed upon. Christians and Christian love, I'm not saying that this is a vice. It is a virtue that Christians should be believing. Sure, eventually you're going to get bit. Sure, at some point you're going to get skint. People come to this church regularly. I should define that. At least once every 3 or 4 months, we're here at 9 o'clock practicing, and some stranger comes to the door. You know what they're wanting? Money. Money for gas. Right? We handle that different. Usually it's me, because I'm usually the only one here that has to deal with that. And you do it just on a kind of a case-by-case basis and kind of how you feel at the moment. But you know, there's been times I've been skint. I've given somebody $20 to go across the street and got gas, and I doubt if they got gas. They probably got some cigarettes. At some point, you will get burned. There's a truth here. Every man, your life, every person in this room, especially if you profess to be a Christian, your life is an open letter for Jesus Christ. Every Christian, whether you like it or not, you might say, I don't want to be that way. It's just tough. If you carry the name of Christ, you are an advertisement for Christianity. The honor of Christ is in the hands of his followers. We judge a shopkeeper by the kinds of goods he sells. We judge a carpenter by the kind of woodwork that he puts out. And the world will judge a church by the kind of men it creates. Men judge Christ by his followers. Dick Shepherd, after years of talking in the open air to people who were outside the church, declared that he had discovered this: the greatest handicap the church has is the unsatisfactory lives of professing Christians. The greatest handicap the church has is the unsatisfactory lives of professing Christians. How many times have we heard some unbeliever justify their evil behavior by some professing Christian's behavior? As we worship together in this place, as we are involved in each other's lives, as you influence my life, and as I influence your life, and as you influence one another's lives, there is this epistle being written in your heart and in our heart. And it is an epistle that is read wherever you go. Let's continue on. Point number two: the foundational differences in a glorious epistle are matters of pen and paper. The foundational differences in a glorious epistle are matters of pen and paper. Notice what in verses 3 to 5, Paul contrasts. The rest of this chapter is just full of contrast. Notice what he says in verse 3. He says, clearly you are an epistle of Christ ministered by us, written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God. He says, you are an epistle. It's not the type of epistle that you write with a pen and ink on paper, but it's an epistle that is being written by the Spirit of the living God. He goes on and says that it is not an epistle that is written on tablets of stone, like the Judaizers want to emphasize. But it's an epistle that is written not on tablets of stone, but on the tablet of your flesh, the tablet of your heart. It's a letter, an epistle being written on your heart. Paul, in verse 4 and 5, he clarifies that he is not the one who has the ability to do this, but rather his sufficiency in his ministry comes from God. It is God who is doing the work through Paul to them. And then Paul begins to compare this work of law and grace in their lives. Point number three: the contrast between the new and old covenant is not the difference between glory or no glory. But that's close. The contrast between the new covenant and the old covenant is not the difference between glory and no glory. But that's close. Let's look at that. You see some contrast here. In verse 6, he says, who also made us sufficient as ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. What two things are contrasted there? The letter and the Spirit. The letter being the law. Our sufficiency is of God in the new covenant, not of the letter, not of the law, but rather of the Spirit. And then he explains that further. He says, for the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. For the law kills, but the Spirit gives life. Now the question that I had immediately was, how is it that the letter kills? How is it that the law kills, but the Spirit gives life? And here is, I believe, the answer to that. The law kills in this way, in that when you look at the law, when you read the law, it condemns you. You see that you are under a sentence of death. The law kills. The law shows you that you are under judgment. The law shows you that you will be condemned. But the Spirit gives life. Look at verse 7 and 8 for more contrast here. For if the ministry of death, written and engraved on stones, was glorious. Now I'm going to leave out some of the next phrases there. Go to verse 8. How will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? Okay, I'm going to read that again just like I did, leave out the five or six lines that explain one of them. For if the ministry of death, written engraved on stones, was glorious, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? What two things is Paul contrasting? The ministry of death with the ministry of the Spirit. Contrasting the two. And he's contrasting their degree of glory. For if the ministry of death, written and engraved on stones, was glorious. What do we know about this ministry of death? It was glorious, wasn't it? It was glorious. Can you imagine Paul saying this ministry of death, this law that brings death, was a glorious thing? He does. And it was. There is something glorious about the law, even though the law kills, even though the law condemns, even though the law judges you, there is something glorious about it. How glorious was it, does he say in verse 7? It was so glorious that the children of Israel couldn't even look at Moses' face when he was carrying it in his hand. That's pretty glorious. It was so glorious, he says, that the children of Israel could not gaze upon Moses because of the glory of Moses when he had been with God getting this law. But Paul's point that he makes is, if this ministry of death can be so glorious, then how much more glorious do you think the ministry of the Spirit would be? We would expect the ministry of the Spirit to be more glorious than the ministry of death, right? And that's his point. That even though this ministry of death was glorious, the ministry of the Spirit, it's reasonable to say and to think, would surely be more glorious than a ministry of death. The ministry of the Spirit that gives life surely is more glorious than this ministry of death that kills. Verse 9, he makes yet another contrast. For if the ministry of condemnation had glory, the ministry of righteousness exceeds much more in glory. What two things are contrasted? Ministry of condemnation contrasted with the ministry of righteousness. And again, his point is the same. There's glory in both, but the ministry of righteousness is so much more glorious than that of condemnation. Verse 10. For even what was made glorious, the law, it was made glorious. He says it had no glory in this way when you compare it to the glory that excels. I could take my phone. I'm not. We won't do this because I probably can't figure out how to turn my flashlight on. My phone, I think, has got a flashlight on. And I can turn it on, and we could turn out the lights in this room, and you could see this light. But we could immediately leave it on and turn on the lights, and what would happen to this? You wouldn't hardly see it, would you? Why is that? Because of the glory of the rest of the light in the room overwhelming my little flashlight. And that's what Paul is saying here. There was glory in the law, but compared to the glory of the Spirit of the living God, the glory of the law pales into insignificance. It is so much inferior to that glory. He makes one more contrast in verse 11. For if what is passing away was glorious, what remains is much more glorious. Two things being contrasted is something that's passing away and something that is remaining. What is it that is passing away? The law, right? The law is passing away. Which one would you think would be more glorious? Something that is passing away or something that remains? Something that remains, right? Right? Because the other is temporary. The other is passing away. It's fading away. It's going away. So we would expect its glory to be inferior to that, the glory of that which remains. That's what Paul is saying. Because he says, if that which was passing away was, if that was glorious, then the thing that remains is much more glorious. Point number four. The epistle written in our hearts is one that gives hope and boldness. The epistle written in our hearts is one that gives hope and boldness. Here's Paul's point. When we look at the epistle and we consider this idea that the law condemned us, but the Spirit of God saved us. The Spirit of God gave us life. And the Spirit of God is working in our heart, writing a letter, writing an epistle on our hearts, one to another. And when we think about that, and we think of how much more glorious that event is than the event of the old covenant, when we think about how much more glorious the new covenant is than the old, Paul says it gives us hope. It gives us boldness so that we can speak, boldness to declare, boldness to walk, boldness to live as a Christian. And he says, not unlike Moses. Unlike Moses, we have such hope and boldness, not like Moses, who put the veil over his face because the glory that was there was fading away. That's not how we live. We don't need to prop up our faith. We don't need to manufacture our Christianity. We don't need to establish this list of things that's going to make us look like a good Christian. We don't need that. God is writing this epistle in our hearts. Yes, we are to live righteously. Yes, we are to do what is right. But the work is a work of God in our hearts. It is not something that we have to fret about whether or not we're going to make it, whether or not it's going to last. It is God's work. And then the last point, and this is the last verse. Paul makes an analogy here. He says in verse 18, but we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord. Picture from this verse in your mind you standing before a mirror. And it's not a mirror where you see your physical body. It's a mirror where you see your spiritual life. Paul says two or three things about this mirror. He says, first of all, you can stand there with unveiled face. In other words, you can stand there and take an honest look at yourself. You can take a transparent look at what's really there. You look at your life, your spiritual life. And you see in this mirror, and what you see is transformation. You see something changing. Here's the point, number five. We are epistles in progress. We are epistles in progress, being written by the Spirit of the Lord with a glory of ever-increasing radiance that does not fade away. Moses' face reflected God's glory. Your life radiates God's glory. Moses' face, the glory of God was here, and his face shone because of a reflection. God's work in us is from the inside out. It is radiating from us. Our lives are not conforming lives. They are transforming lives. Let's remember that. Let's remember that we are an advertisement for Jesus. We are an advertisement for Christianity. What the world sees in you is what they think about Jesus. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. God, I thank you for this heartfelt letter written by this apostle to a church that he loved. Father, would you give us an intensity, Lord, to walk with you, an intensity to love you that is beyond ourselves, that is extraordinary, that is much more glorious, Lord, than just checking off some boxes. Lord, bring glory to yourself when people look at us.